Jeff, are we going to have college football this year?
Man, I sure hope so. It's been a really dreary week.
It's been a roller coaster. I will say, and you and I talked about this before we started the show, I feel better today than I did yesterday. Even probably better than I did this morning, thinking about it.
And not for any reason that I've seen on the media, but on Twitter or anything like that. But I agree. If you would have asked me on, like, I don't know, Sunday, I would have said absolutely not. But here's the thing, and I don't know if enough people are talking about this, and I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I don't even know how to say the word epidemiologist. Is that what it is? I mean, I read it everywhere now. I didn't even know that word existed 6 months ago. Everything that we've heard is about hospitalizations. We've got to protect the healthcare system. Cases are going up. There's no question. Cases are going up in big states, Florida, California, Texas. But hospitals are still okay. And I've been spent some time looking at the stats in the last day or so. And while the cases are still going up, like the total aggregate amount of cases is still going up in these states and in Utah, the daily new case rate has kind of plateaued. It's plateaued at a really high spot, but it's plateaued, and hospitals are still okay. That tells me that unless the daily case rate continues to climb, the hospitals are going to be okay. Even if we're adding 10,000 cases a day in Texas for the next month, hospitals are still going to be okay. And I think as long as hospitals are going to be okay, football is going to be played. Maybe not in California, maybe not the Pac-12, because it's, you know, California is, they're their own animal over there. But Texas, if the hospitals are fine, they're playing football, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that every hospital is fine. I'm sure there's still, depending on the area, some are getting hit harder than others. But I think there's been a lot of scary things when you hear, like, oh, the hospital is like at 85% capacity. It's like ICUs normally run at like 70, 80% capacity. You don't want an ICU, all the crap in an ICU, that's expensive. You don't want that running at 5% capacity because that means you're losing a lot of money, right? Like, right. It's, you know, similar to like when there was no toilet paper. Everyone was buying a month worth of toilet paper at a time. Took a while to catch back up because companies don't have the capacity to make four times the toilet paper than they're going to sell, because that would be stupid to do that, right? And so hospitals, they regularly go over 100% capacity, and they have plans in place to take different things and can, you know, without crazy changes, get up to like 130%. You know, we're not trying to downplay like the seriousness of this, but it's, you know, I think when you look at the age things and how much money there is in football, how much people care about football and college sports in general, and the fact that these are in the top 1% healthiest people on the planet, you know, then I think they're gonna see things try to do it. And, you know, the Big Ten, obviously they're doing conference only. I don't understand how the virus doesn't care about non-conference games. People are saying that it's because, you know, they can have their own testing protocols or whatever, but I don't see why you couldn't have like some testing consortium or whatever you want to call it, where you can say, okay, these are the testing standards we're going to have. We will play you if you commit to this, and every team you play also needs to commit to this standard. And like, that is your network that you can choose from. You want to do that, get two conferences in there. Everyone needs a plus one. BYU will find 12 games. Everybody's happy. You know, Army would do that. They have the money. Navy would do it, whatever. Like, Liberty has more money than they know what to do with because they are a real estate enterprise masquerading as a school, and they will just spend money on whatever they can spend money on. Did you ever hear about when they tried to get into Conference USA?
Yes.
The Conference USA buy-in is $2 million a school because it's a small conference, you know, whatever. They offered $20 million and still got turned down.
Right.
So
Liberty is something else, man.
And, you know, they make BYU seem more normal to the rest of the college football world. And for that, I am grateful. But
yeah,
we
need more liberties out there.
So it's given the demographics of the situation and kind of everything, I think you're going to see the SEC, the ACC try to push through and try to make something happen. And probably in the Big 12 too, since most of the Big 12 is in Texas and Oklahoma. And, you know, if you start to see that come down, which the curve is looking similar to what New York was at the start of all this, where it, you know, it got to a peak, leveled off a little bit, and then just kind of dropped precipitously. And it's, you know, we've kind of seeing the nationwide graphs of, oh, it's picking back up in the US, but really it's places where it wasn't before, right? Like it's, you can't look at the US as some big monolith of this is everything that's going on and this is the US as a whole. It's been different places, different states doing different policies, and it's, you know, it's bad in California, it's bad in Arizona, it's not as bad anymore in New York and New Jersey. It's different things. Everyone seems like is kind of having their run, but hopefully we're kind of past that. I mean, at least hopefully in Arizona, and it's South Carolina, North Carolina is kind of on the list as well. Hopefully we're passing on both of those, because I live right on the North Carolina, South Carolina border right now, and I'm moving to back to Arizona. So I want to steer clear of that. But, you know, it's, I think we will get something. It may start later. It may be 10 games starting the last week of September, and we don't have bowl games, so it just rolls into like December 15th, maybe something like that. Or, you know, even longer, rolling over Christmas, whatever. That, but I think we will get something.
I think so. And I think the fact that schools like Hawaii are already replacing games on their schedule. I mean, I can't remember who it was. Was it Old Dominion? I can't remember who it was. They replaced the first game of their schedule with some FCS school. And I mean, it's not a big name. It's not going to, you know, blow the doors off of Hawaii's football stadium. But there's football. And they reacted within like a week of that game being canceled to replace that game. And that's Hawaii. Like, that's not even big time football. You know, that's Hawaii Mountain West. And Hawaii's kind of the forgotten child of the Mountain West most of the time. And they're making moves to make sure football happens. The Big 12, Bob Bowlesby came out today. And I think he was really deliberate and very intentional in saying, hey, it's too early to be making these decisions. And I think, you know, we have a tendency to want to panic a little bit because, you know, practices were supposed to start today. Like, they could have started today for BYU, July 15th. Well, today of this recording, right? But they didn't. And it's like, well, then it's late. The season's late. Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is a couple of weeks. It starts a couple of weeks late. But I like the approach that Bowlesby and Greg Sankey and a lot of these guys are taking of, it's too early. It's too early. And I think for me, I don't look at the, you know, I don't look at the athletes. I don't look at even to say that, you know, these are the healthiest people in the country, these young college football athletes, they're the lowest risk. I don't even look at any of that stuff. I look purely at hospitalizations. And I think as long as there is medical care capacity, then football will be played. That's my take. And that is just my take. That's not based off of any inside information at all. I do have, I don't know if it's inside information, but I know that BYU is still practicing as if a schedule is going to be played and as if they're going to start football on time. I don't know if that means exactly, you know, September 3rd like it did. Maybe it means September 10th, but they're still planning on playing early September. They haven't started practicing.
They're doing player run practices still, you mean? Because they,
right,
because
yeah, still
the
ruling
was 6 weeks before the game started for your camp to start to make up for spring ball, but our first game and our second game and our third and our fourth game are all gone right now.
Right. So not having full-on practices, but having player run practices, coaches are working on playbooks, they're installing playbooks, there's Zoom meetings, you know, with position groups. They're still preparing as if there's going to be a season and it's going to be playing. And even the Pac-12, right? News broke today. Our friends over at Ute Zone talked about it on their site that Oregon, looks like Oregon's going to be Utah's first game on September 12th. So the Pac-12's doing whatever they're doing, you know, in terms of their Pac-12 only schedule. I think that's weird. But that means football is going to be played on September 12th. And that's the very left-leaning and progressive Pac-12 that is feeling confident enough that they're putting together this schedule and it's leaking to the press. So that tells me football is happening. It may not look the same everywhere, you know, Big Ten, Pac-12, they might do their own thing and everybody else kind of scrambles and it looks sort of the same. Maybe all the P5 conferences play conference only. I don't know, but I think there's going to be football and I feel pretty confident about that.
I hope that the P5s, at least they do some type of plus one. I mean, if the American and the Mountain West do a plus one, then BYU could put together a halfway decent schedule because, you know, Boise would take BYU as their plus one. Utah State would take BYU as their plus one. San Diego State would probably keep that game on the schedule. Hawaii would like to get on that schedule as, you know, something. They would dump the Robert Morris game that they just rescheduled. If, you know, and so there's four games. You add Liberty. You try to get Army. probably get stuck with UConn or New Mexico State, which aren't great, but I mean, that's the same as one New Mexico State. There you go. We played North Alabama. There's our FCS game. And there's, so, you know, that gives us 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 games. And then you find out of the American, like, still get the Houston game, get a game with, you know, get a game with Tulsa again. Or there's a, the American, there's a lot of solid programs that would be good, get good matchups. And we could put together a respectable schedule. I've hearing that things are positive from the direct point of view of the BYU athletic department, and that ESPN is very good in our corner right now. And that, you know, they, it's not just by conferences moving to a conference only schedule. They are, have a lot to rework with ESPN. ESPN lost a lot of content, a lot of valuable content, because people love like that USC Alabama matchup week one in Jerry World. You know, the people love those big non-conference games, and those are really exciting in September, which is, you know, especially that first weekend of college football when everyone is so excited for it to be back on Labor Day weekend. Now getting into that, so ESPN just lost a lot of valuable content. BYU brings eyeballs that ESPN gets on a budget. So there's probably a lot of contract reworking right now. And there's a whole lot of financials that I got to get figured out of, I mean, was it like a, I think it's like force majeure, whatever like the act of God clause is in every contract. Like, right. Does that come into play? How does that fit with this? All that stuff. I'm not a lawyer, especially with contract law, but they, and how this works, but ESPN has to find content. They are struggling for things, and they want BYU, and they can say, hey, BYU, we can broker this and we can figure it out. Like, these teams need stuff. And a lot of times it's especially if they, ESPN has a specific contract where, you know, maybe it is end up being like a Bama thing, because if that USC Alabama game, that's a contracted neutral site game, that is, the rights to that game are owned by ESPN. CBS is the primary rights holder for the SEC. So if that means, okay, we have Bama locked into a contract for ESPN, but Bama no longer has an opponent, okay, we want to get BYU in here because we can pay BYU less, and we can make that, you know, we can give Bama more money than they otherwise would, BYU more money than they otherwise would, still save money on our end because we don't pay both Bama and USC, whatever. You can make all parties happy in that scenario. So I'm not saying that I've heard that, you know, we're going to play Bama. I don't think we are, but it's just, there's just pointing out that there are, you know, out of multiple things, like out of all these other leagues, that ESPN needs content and they want good games, and they will try to help BYU because it doesn't, I mean, I think they're still on the hook for playing BYU, and they'd rather have BYU play in a game than pay them to do nothing.
I do not want BYU to play Alabama.
I don't either.
Like, in my heart of hearts, that game would just get so brutally ugly. I was driving down the street Sunday with my wife, and we saw this cat run across the road, and this cat, it just didn't make it. So there was this truck coming, you know, oncoming traffic or whatever. The cat, it avoided the car who was driving. We were headed north. It avoided the car that was directly in front of me, but the truck that was driving south just totally annihilated this cat. And by the time we drove by, it was like doing the dead wiggle thing, and there was blood everywhere. I mean, this, it really was ugly. It was bad. And I just don't want to see BYU turn into that dying cat when they play Alabama. I mean, I know BYU beat USC. They beat Tennessee. They beat Wisconsin, a top, what were they, top five, top six team a couple of years ago. I don't want to see BYU play Alabama. I love our Cougars, Garrett. I love our Cougars. I do not want to see BYU play Alabama.
I don't want to see them play the Alabama in 2020. Maybe like 2022, 2024, kind of build some things.
Maybe whenever
maybe Nick Saban retires.
Right. Whenever his, you know, ironclad contract that he has signed with Satan that makes him him, whenever that's expired, sure, bring on Alabama. But until that day, I'm not ready. I'm not mentally prepared to see that game. Look, I watched BYU play LSU. They didn't get past the 50-yard line. That wasn't fun for me. It was fun to talk about BYU playing LSU. It was fun to think about BYU playing LSU. But BYU actually playing LSU, that wasn't fun. I don't want that.
And, you know, I just want Nick Saban, please retire. Go take on Tommy Tuberville, who will be the incumbent senator from Alabama.
I love it.
Which I've jokingly said for years that Tommy Tuberville looks like a B-rate actor who always plays a corrupt senator on a TV show. Like, if you like one of that shows, like Designated Survivor or The West Wing or some show like that, Tommy Tuberville looks like he should be a corrupt senator on that show. And now he's halfway there because he just won the primary to become the sitting senator in Alabama. And it's going to be a wild ride. And I don't, in that, whatever Nick Saban does after, like, can you imagine a world where it's like Urban Meyer and Nick Saban run for Congress? That would be,
it'd there be are people nuts. Who,
I mean, Kanye, we talked about, you and I talked about this off the air last week, but sadly Kanye's presidential bid has already come to an end, but let's start one for Nick Saban. Let's get him out of Tuscaloosa for the betterment of the college football world.
Did you see the official Alabama Democrats Twitter account talking about Tommy Tuberville? Let me read this to you, my friend. This podcast, we're so far off of our agenda, but this is gold. So Tommy Tuberville wins the primary. The official, the blue checkmark verified Alabama Democrats at AL Democrats. It's a series of tweets. Let me just read them. He lost his last Iron Bowl 36-0, collects millions of dollars in pension money from hardworking Alabamians and bilked investors based on their trust in his investment advice. Tubbs, Doug's going to run through you like Fred Talley at an 11 a.m. Jefferson pilot game. Next tweet, Tommy Tuberville said he'd never leave Ole Miss in a pine box. Days later, he left for Auburn, never told his players goodbye. At Auburn, he had a wandering eye every year. At Texas Tech, he ditched a recruit during dinner to leave for Cincinnati. Wonder who he's lying to now. Next tweet, Senator Jones got justice for four little girls murdered during church by the Klan. Tommy Tuberville thought a one-game suspension was enough when one of his players raped a little girl. Which one cares more about your daughter's future? And finally, you, scared of your own shadow, can an incumbent Democratic senator win a red state? Us, ready to storm hell with the Super Soaker, Tuberville couldn't score a touchdown for 2 weeks with four first-rounders on his offense, and he lost to Vanderbilt. I want to be a part of Alabama politics so bad. This is incredible. That he didn't score, or he lost to Vanderbilt, is a negative campaign ad for a U.S. senator. I freaking love it. This is what politics is in 2020, ladies and gentlemen.
Like, if we are going to talk about needing a change in politics, this is much better. I am more inspired by that than anything that Congress has done that I can remember in my entire lifetime.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that is enough right there to make me vote Democrat in Alabama. I mean, he lost the last Iron Bowl 36-0. What more is there that I need? As an Alabamian, I don't know what they are, as a person who resides in Alabama, if I know that you can't even score in an Iron Bowl, I'm out. I don't want to associate with you. I love it. Garrett, we're way off track, man. And I don't know if it's going to get any better. Moving into our Hellion of the Week, we really need some nominations from you guys. We've had some excellent nominations. This week, they were a little sparse, and that's okay. I get it. You know, there was a lot of things going on. It was a dark and dreary college football week. So I went ahead and just chose our Hellion of the Week. And for me, it's Ford. Yes, the Ford Motor Company. Because of the Bronco, I have spent the last, I guess, 24 hours, 27 hours now, watching the same clips from the Ford release of the Bronco. I've probably watched, I don't know, 100 times. I am in love with this car. I've loved the Ford Bronco, not as much the Bronco 2, you know, the O.J. Simpson Bronco. I didn't love that as much, but the original Bronco I love. I've always wanted one. I grew up with people who had some, a couple of people who had one, so I'm very familiar with the Bronco. The old Blazers I really liked as well. My uncle has an old Blazer. I just love that true 4x4 SUV, and Ford knocked it out of the park. And I feel like this is an appropriate Hellion of the Week. My uncle, his name is Lloyd Hansen. He has since retired, but he used to be an executive at Ford and was a big BYU fan. Still is a big BYU fan. So I feel like there is a connection there that we can make between Ford and Give 'Em Hell Brigham. And so I'm taking that liberty to talk about the Bronco. Please, SUV lovers and anybody who has seen this Bronco as an is impressed, I want to hear from you this week, because I think it is the I think Ford knocked the release out of the park. You know, I compare it to Tesla, where they're trying to show off the Cybertruck and windows are breaking. The Ford release of the Bronco was perfect. This car looks incredible. I love everything about it. I can't afford it, but I went ahead and reserved one anyways. And really, I'm relying on you guys, listeners of Give 'Em Hell Brigham, to enable my Bronco dreams one day. We're going to have to sell a lot of T-shirts, but that's my goal. That is my goal, is to buy a Bronco. So please support Jeff's goal and help me buy a Bronco by buying our T-shirts.
Do we need to start a GoFundMe for your Bronco?
I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it myself, but if you wanted to start a GoFundMe for me, I'm not opposed.
Okay. If you want to Venmo or PayPal or whatever, Jeff some money to cover his Ford Bronco, please do that. It's, you know, I mean, not all bankers are rich, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of rich bankers. I, unfortunately, am not one of them.
Someday. You're pre-rich. I like to think of myself as pre-rich. Someday, okay, I will get there.
You know, there's actually a saying in banking that for the first 10 years of your career, you're underpaid. And then the next 10 years of your banking career, you're paid pretty appropriately for what you deserve. And then the remaining, however many years you have left, you are just insanely overpaid. And I'm only on year 8. So I'm still in underpaid world. I'm just not there.
You're close, fine, though.
One day I'm going to be insanely overpaid. I can feel it.
Someday you will get there. But yeah. The new Bronco, it's way better than the Chevy Blazer that looks nothing like the old Chevy Blazer. And I don't know what the heck Chevy's doing naming it that. But Ford, you're our Hellion of the Week for doing something right. The Ford Bronco has been a light in these dark times.
And that's been the only thing getting me through.
To our automotive souls. So Quarantine Kitchen. I made ice cream for like the first time in my life. I found an ice cream maker in our garage that I forgot I stole from my in-laws, you know, because we found one at their house that was in an old box and completely dusty and hadn't been opened yet. And we got an ice cream recipe that was pretty simple. It was like a base, you know, that was really easy to make. And so it's like, take the base and then you can kind of mix in whatever flavor you want. If you want, you know, put some chocolate syrup in, if you want to make a chocolate, or just put in some vanilla, or we end up mixing in like a half a cup of just cake mix to make like a cake batter ice cream. It was really good. I'd never made homemade ice cream before. It was cheaper than buying good ice cream at the store. It was about like the same as maybe buying store brand ice cream. That's half more ice than cream. I'll say that. And it was, you know, kind of, it was a fun adventure. So if you ice cream makers are like $15, I would try it again. I've got some ideas of different flavors I want to try things out, but the ice cream maker is a good buy. I recommend it in these summer months.
I like homemade ice cream. My sister makes raspberry ice cream. It's delicious. Ooh. I like homemade ice cream.
We have popsicle. Do you remember as a kid when you're like, oh yeah, I'm just going to get some like Kool-Aid and then freeze it to like make a popsicle?
Yeah.
So we do that with my daughter. So she's she's just over a year and a half now. So we make popsicles. We just take fruit and yogurt and like whipping cream and mix that together and freeze it. So she thinks she's getting ice cream instead of the same yogurt that she eats every other day. That's like high in fat and protein. It doesn't have a lot of sugar, but in her world, it's popsicle and she cannot be happier.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Quarantine Kitchen for me this week, skillet potatoes. This is going to get us a little bit on a rant. The recipe itself, super simple. I use baby red potatoes, slice them really thin, put them in a cast iron skillet, use whatever kind of fat you like, whether it's butter. I like to use bacon fat, or if I have like brisket grease or something that I've left over. Slice these potatoes really thin, put whatever barbecue rub you want over it, and that's it. Just cook your potatoes. It takes like 15, 20 minutes till they start to get crispy. It's really simple, but it tastes like barbecue potatoes. It's really good, but it has to be done on a cast iron skillet. It can't just be done on a regular pan. I mean, I guess I'm sure it could be done on a regular pan, but it's not going to be as good. Cast iron really is the rant, and it's not going to be much of a rant because I think that by and large, everybody who is listening to the show already agrees, but everybody needs more cast iron in your kitchen. I don't care if you already have a lot of cast iron in your kitchen. You need more cast iron in your kitchen. If you are not cooking exclusively on cast iron, you're cooking... maybe just not living up to your cooking potential. How about that? Even the grates on my grills, I have taken out the stock grates and I have cast iron grates on my grills because everything needs to be cast iron.
And cast iron is so cheap. Like, I'm trying to think as I'm turning to look at my kitchen, I have 1, 2, 3. So I have 3 skillets, a flat top, which is a reversible griddle, 2 Dutch ovens, and a bacon press. So I got like 8 pieces of cast iron in my kitchen. And it's, yes, everybody needs cast iron, and it's so cheap. You know, it's, I mean, I do have some stainless steel. The thing is, nonstick pans are overrated. You need one nonstick pan to make scrambled eggs in the morning so you can be lazy about it. But stainless steel and cast iron, everything, I primarily cook on cast iron. I use stainless steel for some things, you know, because I'm not going to boil something in a cast iron pot. I've done that, made soup like in a cast iron, big Dutch oven on the stove before. It just takes too long to heat up. But it's, yeah, you need cast iron. If you ever are going to make a steak in your life, you need cast iron, unless you use the blowtorch. If you have a cereal, you know, if you have a torch, then sometimes that's fun. I do use the torch occasionally. But, you know, yes, everybody needs more cast iron. And you can go down and get a 10-inch skillet at Walmart for like $11, and it will last you
forever
until your fourth great grandchild accidentally drops it and breaks it, because that's the, you know, after, because yep, they let it rust, and then they tried drilling a hole in it, and then they ran it over with a pickup, and then the pickup didn't break it, so they got a bulldozer and ran it over with that, and then finally it cracked.
Yeah, and you don't gotta buy the fancy stuff. It doesn't have to be Lodge brand. It can be just the generic brand cast iron, and it's gonna be great. So yeah, you know, that's really the rant. The skillet potatoes were delicious, by the way, and it's super easy for anybody to make, and it does taste like backyard barbecue. You could probably do the exact same thing and cook it out on a smoker, just get a little smoke on those potatoes. I didn't. I just did it over my stovetop. But the potatoes themselves are delicious. They get a little crispy. You got to preheat the cast iron. It's not like I just throw it in and get lazy with it. If you do that, then the potatoes kind of fall apart. It's kind of gross. But if you let the potatoes... Sorry, if you let the cast iron pan preheat, then put your potatoes in, you get a really good crisp on those potatoes. Think of it like a sear on a steak. It's the same idea. So the potatoes are delicious, but really the cast iron is what matters.
Which that kind of leads me to a segue into another topic. Please preheat your pans when you're cooking. I know you skip that step in the recipe, but really just put the pan on the stove, turn the stove on, and then go through and cut everything that you need for the entire recipe. Get a couple bowls out, slice all your potatoes, slice all of your onions, slice everything you're going to need. Read steps 1 through 8. Get all of it done while the pan is heating up. So you have a nice, evenly warm, heated pan that's hot on the stove to work with. And you will get a much better product in the end when you are finished cooking. Have you ever made, I just also thought of this, have you made like a s'mores dip cast iron? So there's another, if you have a smaller cast iron pan, this works great. Dump in a bag of chocolate chips, dump some mini marshmallows on top of it, throw it in the oven. Ours actually fits in the toaster oven because we have a mini cast iron pan that we use.
It just all comes back to the toaster oven.
Yes. Or I actually got the mini one just for frying stuff because there's only 2 adults and I wanted to use less oil. So I got like a 6-inch skillet with high walls so I could use half as much oil to fry something. But you throw it in there, you know, put it in the oven until the marshmallows get toasty, and then you just have the chocolate underneath and you just break off graham crackers. It's like eating chips and salsa, but dessert with s'mores. It's wonderful.
If it feels like we're a little bit more rambly today, or, you know, we're really not talking about sports yet, we will. We have a great show. It's late, man. I mean, it's later than it normally is. It's 10 o'clock for me. It's nearly midnight for Garrett. So this show, We're gonna ramble a little bit more than we normally do. But we do have a great show. We're going to get into the sports now. As always, support us on Teespring. Before we get into this, we'll put our link in the show notes. But support us. Buy a shirt. We're trying to keep this podcast ad-free. We feel like the best way to generate any sort of revenue on this is by selling some, you know, merchandise of some sort. We've chosen t-shirts. We have face masks now, you know, things like that. It's on our Teespring site. The revenue helps supplement the revenue that we're missing out on by trying to not have ads on this show. Great show today. Brett Ciencia from Pick Six Previews joined us. We will play that interview a little bit later on. Really great, great content from him. His book is awesome, his preseason book that he does every year. Special promo code. We'll talk about it now real quick. He'll talk about it later. Enter BYU as your coupon code at checkout. Get 30% off of your preseason magazine for Pick Six Previews. It's one of the best. He only previews the P5 teams. He talks today in the interview that we'll play. He talks about where he considers BYU in that P5 mix. I think that will make most BYU fans happy. And he talks about his game grader formula and really where that places BYU within the P5 landscape. It's basically reinforcing what a lot of BYU fans already believe. Great interview. We'll play that a little bit later. But to start, there was some news kind of on the administrative side of BYU athletics this week. A new Cougar Club director. This is Garrett. I mean, this is right up your alley in terms of the kind of the administration, if you will, of sports and the athletic department. What are your thoughts on BYU's new new Cougar Club director?
I am very neutral, I would say, because it was, I think, anyone who's ever dealt with the Cougar Club knows that it leaves a lot to be desired. It's not the most aggressive organization in terms of fundraising. It seems to be run similar to most other schools where the primary benefit is tickets. But BYU, compared to other schools, has a disproportionate number of fans that do not live within driving distance of the stadium. And so there's not a lot of benefit for those fans that live outside of, you know, the Wasatch Front. And you have, you know, a lot of, you know, it's really hard for fans really to see what the benefit is beyond, hey, I just want to support the program. And, you know, if you have a Cougar Club membership, you can get up to 12 tickets on a single membership. That's way too many compared to every other school. They need to, you know, I would think they would need to cut that down to drive some more revenue and do more things. But it's, I was hoping that we'd get some outside blood and get some new blood coming in, especially with the amount of business acumen that there is across, you know, across Utah County, Salt Lake County, and even you guys up in Davis County and Clearfield. You know, there's some brains up there as well. But the
we know some stuff.
Yes, and so I was hoping to kind of get some new eyes and new blood in there. They ended up promoting Greg Vahar, who was the number two kind of vice president or assistant director, whatever the title was. He was the number two in command, and he's had that position for 20 years and now is moving up. So obviously he will obviously do some things different just because everyone is different. But my initial reaction is, okay, I live on the other side of the country. It's, this person has been there for a long time. How much different is it going to be? You know, and it's, I kind of posted about this in our, in the thread on our VIP board, where I would like to see some move away from just you get tickets or whatever to some type of point system where it's, you know, if you're this member, you get, you know, this many tickets, you get this many points. And it's like a ticket is 2 points, like one football ticket is 2 points, a basketball ticket is 1 point, or, you know, you can get this exclusive, here's a little shop of exclusive Nike gear. That's so many points. So at least, I mean, I would be happy to give, it's like, okay, if I pay $500 a year for the Cougar Club, if I lived in Utah, I would pay $500 a year because I want better football tickets. That's really, I'm paying for the football tickets. You know, outside, if I'm living outside of that, maybe I give $50 or $100. I'd be a lot more likely to want to give $250 if I knew that I was going to get a new Nike polo every year that would normally be $70, $75. But yes, it's, I, you know, but I'm getting that as a Cougar Club exclusive and make it a status symbol, you know, to where you show up at games and you see stuff like, oh man, that is the best design. Like, sure, I want that, but like, you can only get that if you're part of the club. You know, try to make it something, you know, to really bring in people from out of state, because there are just too many, there's too many alumni, and not even alumni, that, you know, how many, there's tons of fans across the country. Like you didn't go to BYU, but you're the biggest BYU fan I know because you grew up around it and who want to support the program would be Cougar Club members, even though they aren't an alumni. So there's what, 500,000 living alumni, however many hundreds of thousands of fans who are not official alumni who would be willing to donate, but there's really just not a tie outside of, I want to get in line for football tickets. And so I want to see some creativity from that, regardless of who's in charge. If I've talked about this with you, talked about this with other people as well, of kind of what kind of things we'd like to see. So if you hear this, I'll give you my number. You can call me. We can put something together or just like talk. You know, I think there's a lot of things that can be done just to try to get people more involved.
What I would like to do, I mean, this is selfish desires a little bit, but hey, if you're a Cougar Club member, Greg Behar, give me a call. Let's work it out so that there's some revenue share, that every Cougar Club member gets a comped access to Cougar Sports Insider, brought to you by 24/7 Sports. The Cougar Club can pay us directly, and the Cougar Club, I guess the member themselves, they're just donating to the Cougar Club. Part of their Cougar Club membership is a VIP membership at Cougar Sports Insider. I think it's great. I think it's a great idea. I hear you. You know, the number two guy after 20 years gets promoted. Here's my counter. And, it, you know, I say this a little bit in jest, but also with a little bit of sincerity. And here's what I hope. Russell M. Nelson was an apostle for 34 years before he was the prophet. And now scouts are dead. Church is 2 hours long. There's a lot of things that have changed in the just over 2 years since he has, you know, become the prophet. Now, at the risk of going on to a, you know, a ledge of sacrilege here, I don't think that we should judge Greg Behar too harshly because he, you know, was the incumbent guy, because he was the guy who's been there for so long and he wasn't able to make any of the changes or do any of the things that we hope the Cougar Club will do in the future. I think that it's fair to be skeptical, but I do think he deserves the benefit of the doubt. You know, ultimately he had to report, he was the number two guy. He wasn't the number one guy, meaning that there was somebody else who got to call the shots at the end of the day. I do think that now that he gets to call the shots, who knows? He's been sitting on ideas for who knows how long. Maybe not. Maybe he runs everything and keeps it the status quo. But I think that he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He might come in and make some pretty drastic changes. We'll have to see. But I think he deserves that chance before, you know, he gets judged too harshly, or before BYU gets judged too harshly for, you know, taking the easy hire that was there.
Yeah, and yeah, agreed. I don't want to say this is a horrible said. It doesn't, you know, in super excite me. Like, I'm very much sure we'll see what happens. I'm very neutral on this. It's, you know, because obviously the Cougar Club, it could be a lot worse than it is. But I think given the number of fans and support for the program, that there's only about 5,000 memberships, that leaves a lot to be desired. And it's, I know, at least when I first graduated, the outreach to try to get new alumni in and kind of get them donating, it was something I think could be worked on. So when I moved to South Carolina, I saw these stickers, these Clemson stickers everywhere, and I was so confused. And then I'm watching a South Carolina game, you see it on the field too, it's IPTAY. And I was like, what the heck? So IPTA, instead of the Cougar Club, it's not the Tiger Club, whatever, it's IPTA is the name of the booster organization at Clemson. And that is an acronym for I Pay 10 a Year, because it started out way back in the day of, okay, we have this booster club. It's like, dude, you can't afford 10 bucks a year, 83 cents a month. You know, you can't pony up 10 bucks to support this thing. Like,
that's cool.
What kind of cheapskate are you? So they have more individual donors than any other booster club in the country, because, you know, they get that low thing, at least, like, you know, maybe you don't get anything for it, but hey, you give 25 bucks a year to the school. Like, you don't get anything exchanged for that level, but hey, you are part of it. And it's like, if you are an alumni, the expectation is you will give at least the 50 bucks, no, 25, 50 bucks a year back to the athletic program, because that's what you do as a Clemson alumni. I would love for BYU to do that. You know, there's what, 33,000 students. Okay. If, you know, get 20 bucks out of 10,000 of those, like, that would be incredible. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, so it's at least get their foot in the door and then start letting them level up, or, you know, hopefully it's only 20 bucks. They won't even notice that they have it on an auto withdrawal and they've been members for 5 years. Who cares? You got the money from them.
It's true. And I think that's a fair proposal. I do think that I think BYU fans need to be – I think that there's improvements that need to happen on both sides. It's tough to give money. I think that BYU fans by nature – I'm not going to, you know, get into a religious because of tithing or whatever. I think that's not it. But BYU fans by nature are reluctant to donate. And they have reasons for being reluctant, and that's fine. The Cougar Club needs to improve and remedy some of those reasons. But BYU fans need to show that, hey, look, we're going to support this team financially as well. So Cougar Club, try to work harder because there's money to be had. Things like, you know, it's just hard. You know, I remember as a kid watching moms come into Lavelle Edwards Stadium with full-fledged, like, plastic bowls of popcorn and candy bars stuck inside there in this popcorn bowl hidden underneath their coat coming into a night game because, you know, heaven forbid you pay the $4 for a bowl of popcorn or whatever it is at the stadium itself. I mean, there's just too many things like that. There's still too many, you know, too many tan shirts at Lavelle Edwards Stadium on game days that it makes it look like, well, look, BYU fans don't really care. And so maybe that is it fans' fault that the Cougar Club doesn't try harder? No, but if you're the leader of the Cougar Club, are you going to look at that and see, you know, and maybe be a little bit more reluctant to roll out a whole bunch of crazy programs? Possibly, right? So I think that I think that both sides need to do a little bit better. There was some football news this week. We talked about Hinkley Ropati last week, I believe before anybody else started talking about him, that he was on BYU's radar, an offer was likely, and that if an offer came, we wouldn't have been surprised at all if he committed. Well, lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. An offer came, and he committed, I believe it was Thursday of last week, so the day or two, maybe it was Friday, a couple of days after we talked about him on the podcast and on our VIP message board. Ropati got his official 24/7 Sports rating today. The network did a huge rating release. That's one of the great things about 24/7 is their ratings are fluid and based on camps, based on film, based on performance, you know, during games, based on feedback from our national evaluators, from the individual site publishers like me, from high school coaches, like those ratings can constantly change. They go up, they go down. Sometimes they stay the same, but there's always an evaluation and a reevaluation up until signing day when that player signs. Other sites aren't like that. Other sites, they will generate a rating, and that rating tends to stay the same unless P5 offers start to roll in. And depending, you know, I don't know if it's the top 100 kids, the top 1,000 kids, but at these other networks, and I can say this because I've worked at these other networks, those star ratings are generated based off of algorithms that look at offers, and they go ahead and they say, okay, you got a BYU offer, that's a high 2-star offer. Oh, wait, now you got an Oregon offer that came with it. Okay, well, your Oregon offer plus your BYU offer and nothing else, that makes you a low 3-star. And that's how the rating system works. But at 24/7, it's based off of film. I had conversations with Greg Biggins about Hinkley Ropati this week, looking at film and looking and talking about what we had heard about him, what we saw on film, what we liked, what Biggins saw at a camp or whatever. So the rating that came out for Hinkley Ropati was an 84 for the 24/7 Sports rating. Now that may not sound like a spectacular rating. It's a really solid 3-star. The way that the 24/7 Sports ratings work, if you're not familiar, anything from 80 to 89 is a 3-star. So an 84 is a solid middle of the pack 3-star athlete. For BYU, a running back who's going to have 3 years of eligibility, so not a grad transfer, a running back with a rating of 84, this is the highest ranked running back, I believe, since Jackson McChesney in 2017. So a higher rating than
guys get like, knocked down a little bit. So if he was coming out of high school, he'd probably be in that 86, 87 range.
Yep, that's correct. So that's a higher rating than, you know, Luve Hilu, who signed last year, Bruce Garrett, who signed last year, Lopini Katoa, who's done what Lopini Katoa has done, a higher rating than Sione Finau. This is a really good commit for BYU. look, we talked about Ropati and kind of what he brings to the table from a player standpoint. He plays like a big back. Now, when I've heard this question already, I've called him a big back. He's drawn comparisons to Fui Vakapuna, and then people go and they pull up his profile and he weighs like 210, 215 pounds. He'll probably play at about 220, 225 maybe when he gets to BYU. The guy's like 5'9". Like, he's not a big dude. So 220, 5'9", that's a thick dude. He plays big, and I'm really excited to see what he brings to the table at BYU because of Harvey Unga. There are a lot of comparisons about Harvey Unga in the way that they play the game. I don't know if he becomes Harvey Unga or not. Nobody does. But I think that there is a lot of reason to be optimistic about Ropati reaching his ceiling, wherever that ceiling is, because of Harvey Unga being his position coach. So this is a big deal. An 84, one of the higher rated running backs that BYU has signed in the last five recruiting classes. It's a big deal.
I'm excited. I love his game and his tape is awesome. And we talked about it last week. It's just, he runs hard, and that's my favorite kind of player, is just somebody who you can tell that the effort is there on every single play and it jumps out at you.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right.
So next thing that we have on here was, we did want to talk about, you put on that you wanted to talk about jerseys, at least royal on royal jerseys. So what did you mean by this? What if we go, did we already now, fill off?
Let me tell you what I meant by this. Dave Broberg, for those of you who don't know Dave Broberg, he is the creative design director for BYU Athletics. He tweeted today, football 2020 season photo shoot. And he just posted a picture of, I believe this is Jackson McChesney. And it's a royal on royal jersey combination. White helmet, royal top, royal bottoms. This is a controversial jersey combination for BYU. This isn't a throw it back to Lavelle. Like, they never wore royal on royal during Lavelle. This is very much a new twist on the old colors of BYU. BYU's worn it before. They wore it a few times. Most recently that I can remember was in the famous Idaho Potato Bowl. But what's different with this rendition of royal is the shade of royal is just a touch darker, a little bit closer
to the actual royal. The last time we've has been a weird lighter color with a metallic face mask in that Kurt Taysom Hill Utah State game and then the Idaho Potato Bowl. But I pulled up the picture and it does look better. They are much better.
It's the old royal. I mean, that's what it is. This is the Kevin Federick royal, right? Like, this is what this reminds me of. It's not quite Jim McMahon royal. It's closer to that 90s royal, but royal on royal, I like it. I mean, I'm a fan of royal on royal. I don't think a lot of people are, though. I think I might be in the minority. I think a lot of people like white on white, but I don't know. Garrett, what do you think of the royal on royal combo?
I do like, actually, this is completely off tangent before I jump into this and it's fitting for the episode. One of my favorite things in BYU history of knowledge is the fact that Kevin Federick went and played in the CFL and his dad bought a CFL team so he could be on the roster. One of my favorite sports things of all time.
That is amazing.
But this royal, as I'm looking at this picture, it looks like it is Jackson McChesney. The darker royal is so much better. Like, that is the classic royal. I think the first time they did wear the royal on royal was the 2013 game against Utah. And they wore it at home. And it was just that weird lighter color. And then even some other seasons, there have been slightly lighter colors. Like in the Potato Bowl, it would seem like it was even lighter. Though I don't know if that was just because it was against the turf. Just, it's kind of optics. But this is the darker. It is the classic, royal that we all love, except for some people love to hate it. I don't understand those people. I am not one of them. I am very much team royal.
And contrarians, that's all they are.
The worst kind of people. And
objectively, royal is better. Everybody knows.
So I mean, looking at this now, I do like the look because it actually fits and it feels like BYU. The previous iterations of royal and royal that we've seen just didn't feel like it was BYU. It felt like it was something weird, like
I don't know, some weird pro combat jersey that went askew. Yeah, I agree. This looks good. I like it. The thing I don't know about the Royal on Royal is I don't know what shoes you wear. We're getting into weird stuff, but I like white shoes with it, but I feel like if you're wearing this at home, you got to wear dark shoes. I don't know. So that's just me. But I like the Royal on Royal. I think it's a good look. So that's really all that I wanted to talk about with that. That's a great segue, not at all, into our interview with Brett Ciancia of Pick Six Previews. Really great stuff from Brett, so let's jump into that now. Okay, now we are joined by the legendary Brett Ciancia of Pick Six Previews. If you aren't familiar with Pick Six Previews, I don't know what you're doing wrong. You should be familiar with Pick Six Previews. One of the, if not the most premier preseason college football preview that's out there. It's new. You know, there's others out there, Athlon, Phil Steele, they get the notoriety and maybe some of the fame. But when it comes to content and accuracy, there is not anybody better than Brett and better than this Pick Six Preview magazine. Brett, tell us a little bit about the book and how it came to be, how long you've been doing this. Kind of introduce yourself to BYU fans.
Yeah, Jeff and Garrett, I appreciate you guys having me on and for all the praise on Twitter too. I launched Pick Six Previews back in 2012 as a college football preview site. Those first seven seasons, my Power 5 and BCS predictions were graded most accurate in the country. That's not me saying it. That's Stassen.com has been grading publications that you see on newsstands and online. They've been grading them for decades. So most accurate those first seven seasons. Last year, 2019, I put together my first comprehensive book, you know, all Power 5 teams included, 1,500 words per team, but kind of a deeper dive than you see on newsstands. I try and get more program history in there, coaching schemes, X's and O's, because, a good balance of my analytics, but also making it very readable, too, for the fans. So after the 19 book, I was selected to become a Heisman Trophy voter. And then this year, 2020, is my second annual book. And added BYU to the mix because, I mean, I couldn't leave out this fan base. You guys might as well be Power 5 by whatever, you know, label they try and throw. I mean, you have a national title. You're, at the top of most win lists over any kind of year intervals since the 70s on. So and have the fan base more passionate than a lot of the Power 5 ones anyway. So it's been great connecting with a lot of the BYU media, a lot of the fans. I mean, I always saw you guys every day on Twitter against Utah, the Utah fan base. That's a, what I call a 365-day rivalry. I see it every day on Twitter. But yeah, so I'm excited to have really done a deep dive into BYU, applied all my formulas and metrics, and excited to talk about it.
So the kind of the main thing that we'll see in the magazine is you have, like, your game grader. So you mentioned you've been doing the prediction since 2012. Did that start out with you just kind of reading on the teams and going like a gut hunch, or have you been iteratively working on these formulas with your grading system since 2012?
Or when back in 2012, it wasn't as, I had some numbers involved. I was building some formulas. A lot of it was gut. But as I started going along, I tried to just mold my formulas to kind of the logic I was trying to put in there anyway, to get a number on things. So, I mean, I'm a numbers guy. The game grader, what that is for those folks that are new, it's a formula where I dig deeper than the box score because, you know, when you see a 7-5 record, you know, that doesn't really tell the whole story of a team's season. It could be an easy non-conference schedule. It could be a lot of close, barely wins, a lot of blowouts. So what I do is, you know, scoring differential, yardage differential, per play metrics, efficiency, explosiveness, and all of that is packaged together. And then at the end, adjusted for opponent strength because, you know, beating Rice 50-0 or 50-0 is different than beating Alabama 50-0. So it's all scaled to pace of play and opponent strength. And I know that sounds like a terrible word salad, all of that, but basically it's my way to dig deeper than the box score and get a real number on a team. And as it applies to BYU, it's a little bit different because for these Power 5 conferences, I have a consistent pool of teams that they're playing, you know, 8 or 9 common opponents each season that they're playing, and I can grade them against each other. But with BYU, it's kind of an outlier being an independent. But I applied the same numbers through, and they graded out 39th out of 66 in the Power 5. So about middle of the pack if they were to be applied into the Power 5 ranks. And that's sixth in the Pac-12 last year. So right in the middle. And I think that that's fair. I think that's what BYU fans would expect. When you break it down, since they went independent after that musical chairs of conference realignment in 2011, they are 44-20 against non-AQ. So, you know, two thirds, 17-27, about 40% against the Power Five. So I think that middle tier, that middle of the pack rank is kind of accurate to what we see on field.
Would you take a look, Brett? Would you say that? And I think most BYU fans first are thrilled, you know, to be included in your eyes with the P5. When you look at BYU, kind of middle of the pack, and you rattle off some of those records against, you know, the segregated college football as a whole, what does it take for BYU to take the next step forward in your mind? Looking at all of these pack or all of these Power Five teams, rather. What does BYU need to do to elevate their status within that group?
Yeah, well, I think it's a couple things. I remember right when BYU first went independent, the schedules weren't as loaded with Power Five opponents. That started to come in the later years. And even this year, I think it was six on the schedule there. And so I think scheduling is important. You want to be in these premier matchups against some top 25 opponents, some Power Five teams, to really just for narrative sake and perception sake, you know, throw your weight around and beat some of these Power Five opponents more consistently. So the scheduling is certainly there. I think try and get back to some of that defensive excellence that you saw under Bronco Mendenhall. You know, I applied back my defensive grades and all that the past decade. And really, I mean, Mendenhall's defenses, and you guys already know this, but they were super aggressive. They were attacking, making a ton of plays behind the line of scrimmage. And I just remember watching games. I mean, they don't miss tackles. They were aggressive. They were hard hitting. Got to get back to that. The defense has slid a little bit, not just statistically overall, but in terms of style, it's a lot less aggressive. It's a bit safer. And that's good and bad, but it's just different. So I think getting back to a top 25 consistent defense would be great for BYU. And then taking that offensive step that I expect this fall, we could talk more on that, but I expect an offensive step forward. But I think, continuing to throw your weight around in these Power Five games, really own the national stage when you get that chance. You got to knock out Utah. I mean, that's a monkey on the back right now. It's a trend you got to get rid of because that quiets down their fan base a bit, but then also just for, you know, regional pride and recruiting perception, that's big.
You know, it's painful for us to talk about that Utah series. We don't like to talk about that losing streak very much here.
We avoid it as much
You're
as possible.
You're touching on a sore spot.
So you mentioned that there was a bit of a style change with the defense, and obviously compared to the Mendenhall defenses that really BYU fans have grown accustomed to, you know, because offensively we've struggled for some time, but we're very much in the fans' mind, we see ourselves as a defensive school. But last year there was a step back, and you mentioned the defensive change. So kind of what is your perception on Elisa Tuiaki as a defensive coordinator, as well as Jeff Grimes, who as an offensive coordinator, really when, you know, both stylistically or how they perform in your game grader formula? Because I think it's safe to say that most BYU fans are pretty iffy on both. And if both of them got replaced, the majority of fans would probably see it as a good thing or a step forward. So what do you see happening going forward with them?
Yeah, well, I think 2020 is definitely a huge year for both of them. We'll start with the offense. Grimes has taken it. He improved it last year by 18% in my percentile grades. That doesn't sound like much, but that's significant. And that was even going through a ton of injuries up front. Even with all that, those line changes and different combos up front, it was still a pretty decent unit offensive line-wise, and everyone's back healthy this year. Brady Christensen's a star at left tackle, so I think it takes a step forward at least up front. The receiver core, you know, you're never going to have a 1,000-yard receiver in this offense. The ball is spread very, it's spread thin across 9 or 10 different receivers. That's not a bad thing. It's fresh legs, but it's just different. So, a lot of the parts are back. Zach Wilson back, quarterback. He showed some ups and downs. That bowl game when he went perfect passing the ball, and then even Romney last year took over in some parts. So, you know, there's a lot to like offensively. I think that the big step forward we thought would happen last year is going to then happen this fall. And then defensively, like I said, it's not so much that they're bad defenses. It's just that it's different stylistically. It looks different. Instead of bringing those, you know, heavy blitz packages and, you know, getting all these sacks or, you know, Kyle Van Noy leading the nation in sacks, that kind of thing. It's more safer. It's more bend, don't break. And there are some positives to that. I mean, they don't allow the long play. They're very good against long yardage plays. Against certain offenses too, that bend don't break really works. You saw it against USC, a pass heavy air raid who really had success on everyone. I mean, they toasted Utah too. But what BYU was able to do was drop 8 in the coverage, very safe, but effective. And it really, confused that freshman quarterback Slovis and forced him in, I think, 4 or 5 picks. So, there's some pros and cons. It's just different than what you're used to. This year, huge, huge test for both sides of the ball. And I think both sides will improve, though.
Brett, I want to get in. You mentioned a few players, Zach Wilson, Brady Christensen. I want to, as you look at this BYU team, are there a handful of players? I guess who are the players that stand out to you that in order for BYU to be successful in 2020, these 3 or 4 players have to stay healthy and take a step forward. Who would those players be?
Yeah, well, I think right off the top, Matt Bushman. I mean, everyone talks about him, but it's rare for a guy, a tight end, to lead the team in receiving yardage. Maybe outside of Iowa, but it's rare. And then to do it 3 straight years is even more rare. So I think Bushman is huge to this offense, both in the blocking game but also the pass game. So look for him to be, again, the key piece. The backfield has a lot of nice parts to it. You bring in Devontae Henry Cole, a former Utah guy who was stuck behind Zach Moss, just adds some Power 5 depth. And then even I think Finau and Katoa, I think it was Finau who was picked for the Doak Walker watch list just today. So, there's a lot of stars on offense that could be put to work here and tote the ball. So a lot to like there. On defense, I think, the linebackers really, there's plenty of them. They're moving around now in this 4-2-5 base scheme. They were, the last couple of years in a 3-man front, shifting back to a 4-2-5. Moving those linebackers into new spots, some nickel packages, bringing an extra guy in on the line with his hand down on the ground. So it'll look different, but a lot of pieces to like too. But I would lean – it's definitely offense first this year.
That's good stuff. And one thing, just not about BYU, that really kind of stood out to me when I opened up the book this year for the first time. I love your predictions for the 4 teams in the college football playoff. I didn't love it as much last year when we saw that red helmet with the Utah logo in there, but I like it a lot this year. Oregon and Florida joining Ohio State and Clemson. I think a lot of people would have told you Ohio State and Clemson. And I know that there's some hype, there's some excitement about Oregon and Florida this year, but I think anybody betting against Bama is going to be a little bit – I mean, they got a little bit of explaining to do, right? So tell me what you see from Oregon and Florida or maybe what you don't see from Alabama this year.
Yeah, it's funny, Jeff. When I made the prediction last year, I got a lot of, let's call it feedback, quote-unquote, on Twitter. But you know what? For what it's worth, it was a heck of a run. I mean, it was a roulette chip coming in with Utah. They were pre-ranked around 17th or 15th. So to put them fourth, that was pretty bold. And going into that last Friday of the season against against Oregon in the Pac-12 title, they were a win and in. If they won that game, they'd have been in the playoffs. So, but further, I was the only one in America to not have Alabama. All 20 preseason mags and publications had Bama last year. I was the only one against the grain. I'm not trying to put that out there on purpose, but just before I talk about these outlier picks, it's not just throwing crap at the wall. So yeah. So with Florida this year, I really like them being in the third year of Dan Mullen's offense and Ty Grantham's defense. These are coordinators that have had success everywhere. Mullen specifically is kind of a quarterback whisperer. I mean, you saw him way back at Utah with Alex Smith. He did it down in Mississippi State with Dak Prescott. And then even in Gainesville 10 years ago, he was the coordinator on those Urban Meyer teams when they were rotating in Chris Leak and Tim Tebow. Long story short, he's got probably the best quarterback in the conference this year with Kyle Trask. The defense has been excellent the last 10, 20 years. It's always producing NFLers. That's not going to change. The reason I have Florida up there is because finally the offense and the quarterback position specifically are stabilized and looking like strengths for once. So big on Florida. Anti-Alabama again this year. I mean, their defense kind of took a step back last year, and I know for them that's still top 15 caliber, but this is no longer the best unit in the country. Saban had never allowed 45 points in a game to an SEC team coming in. He did it twice. He allowed it twice in November alone. You know, so a little bit of a slide there. Their entire secondary is gone. Both edge rushers were top 50 picks, gone. And plus, yeah, you lose Tua, who was a generational quarterback there. So that's why I'm leaning Florida. Real quick on Oregon, you guys see it on the West Coast. I mean, this is a great, strong defense. They were top five last year. They returned 10 starters off that unit, off that defense. The only vacancy is at linebacker, but it's not just one, but two five-star prospects coming in to fill that one void. So, again, a top, you know, a top five, top three defense in America. Now, to the outsider, outside the West Coast, everyone kind of assumes Oregon is this, you know, this Chip Kelly gadget offense where it's speedy, but they don't have anything in the trenches, and they show up small in the big game. But Mario Cristobal has built this the opposite. He's built this from the trenches out. He's an offensive line guy himself. He's a guru there. And you see it. I mean, they're physical. They out-physicaled Utah in the title game, and then a month later out-physicaled Wisconsin, who, I mean, that's offensive line U, and they held them 100 yards below their rushing average. So, long story short with Oregon, yeah, they have to replace four linemen, four starting offensive linemen. The four guys coming in, though, are higher recruits than their predecessors. Plus, they brought in Joe Moorhead, who I think is the coordinator hire of the season. And the last note is that for the first time since the 1990s, a program not named USC is now the highest rated recruiter, five-year average in the Pac-12. So they have the guys to do it, they have the coaches to do it, and the schedule was favorable. So I went with Oregon.
That's great. You know, I didn't realize that Oregon had, you know, really, when you said, when you mentioned them jumping, I didn't realize that the five-year average now was that high, and obviously USC has slipped the last few years. One last question before we let you get out and on. I know you have a few other interviews scheduled. So going back to the game grader, or just kind of your general process week to week, what does that look like either from, you know, a technical standpoint? Are you, you know, scraping, manually downloading all of these things and putting it together yourself in a spreadsheet, or do you have like a script that runs and then you kind of dive into that and say, you know, what matchup sticks out based on the numbers, or kind of, so what does your weekly, week to week preparation look like in terms of updating all your numbers and then getting your content up, just for those who might be curious of how, you know, what this looks like now that it's, you know, I don't know if it's a full-time job for you, but it's something that you've built into a large credible site.
Yeah, it's an insane amount of time that goes into the book. The book itself, the annual, that's, you know, a ton of film study, calls with coaches, calls with coordinators, watching spring games. I didn't have that tool this year, obviously. But then the advanced stats also, my numbers too. So I try and get a nice balance. But yeah, with the numbers piece, it's scraping through box scores, pulling some key stats, and then putting them into my workbook and running my formulas. What I do week to week is I put together, you know, my game grader projects what the Vegas line should be in my formula's opinion. And then I look at that opening line that comes out on Sunday. And if there's any major variances, say more than, you know, 4 or 5 points where, you know, game grader's one way and Vegas is the other, that's a significant outlier. And in those games, it was 61% last year predicting. So there's some success there. I'm going to look into putting out a weekly type newsletter type thing. You know, running the numbers each week for the fans. I hadn't released that last year, call it a test run, if you will, with that, but it certainly succeeded. So I'm excited to get more, you know, content outside of just the preseason book, which is comprehensive enough. But once the bullets start flying during the season, you know, you need some updated numbers and updated data to match what you're watching. So yeah, a lot goes into it. I appreciate you guys taking a look and spreading it on Twitter. I'm excited to connect with BYU fans all across the country.
Well, Brett, we appreciate you hopping on with us today. Absolutely cannot recommend this book enough. Tell people where they can find it, how much it costs, all that good stuff.
Yeah, thanks. It's at Pick Six Previews on Twitter. That's all spelled out. And then it's picksixpreviews.com. And on there I have a couple sample teams, because, again, I know it's a newer product. A couple sample teams so you can see the level of detail, the set of stats and graphics you get per team. Couple testimonials in there too. I just got one back from ESPN's Chris Felica, the Bear, as we know him. That was pretty cool. But then also, if you're interested, just type in BYU at checkout and you get a nice discount. I want to get back to the fan base here. And make sure to connect on Twitter and give me your feedback, what you think. So yeah, appreciate you guys having me on.
Appreciate it, Brett.
Thank you. It was great.
So that was our interview with Brett Ciancia. So, Jeff, what did you think about you know, I was very impressed with him, mostly just in terms of the preparation that he did for a lowly little podcast like us, in terms of, you know, he was very, very knowledgeable about BYU, even, you know, talking about the scheme change on defense specifically and knowing multiple players' names. So even if he wasn't pulling that out of the top of his head, he was very well researched. And I think that shows how good of a publication his preview is.
Yeah, and I could tell that you were kind of nerding out with him. Like, you wanted to know all that nerdy detail about how the game grader formula works.
I am.
I love the way that he's kind of just come out of nowhere. Like, it's almost like the Ken Palm, and I think this is on his website, in fact, but kind of like the Ken Palm of basketball. Like, Ken Pomeroy just does his own thing, and he has for a million years, and now he's, like, universally accepted as the college basketball god. And I feel like Brett Ciancia has that same kind of potential because of the amount of work that he does. I love the respect that he gives BYU. I mean, you heard him, right? That BYU might as well be a Power 5 school. This guy interacts with Power 5 fans everywhere. He talks to Power 5 coaches and athletic directors everywhere across the country. And he considers BYU right on par with the rest of them, right? With the rest of those P5 schools. No, BYU is not Ohio State. They're not Notre Dame. But BYU is every bit on par with Cal, you know, with Oregon State, with Indiana, you know, with that mid-tier of Power 5 schools. And I think that's where BYU should expect to be. So it's cool for me to hear that level of respect from a national guy when, you know, too often the national media kind of dismisses BYU and they dismiss independence as kind of a joke. I like what Brett has to say about BYU. I think he's fair. I think he's reasonable. And I think that really shows when he talks about the Cougars.
Yes. And he was very optimistic, and I felt reassuring to me that he's gone through, you know, and looked at data and cut, you know, he has his own formulas and they're proprietary, whatever. But he did point out that his game grader, where there was a lead last year, was 62, almost 62% against the spread, which is a very profitable formula. And I'm very excited to see if that holds up this year, because I would start paying for picks from him because that appears to be a very valuable investment. But he basically hit on terms of what things look like going forward, everything we talked about in our offensive defensive previews, that there was a scheme change, kind of head scratching, but whatever it was, they need to tighten things up there. The offense took a very large step last year and was much better than it was in 2018. It just didn't get into the end zone. And so they need to close that out, but they're like 95% of the way there. And this is going to be the year where they put it together, hopefully. And if they don't put it together this year, then maybe you got to go back to the drawing board. So it was kind of good in revalidating our opinions by someone who, you know, is considered by many to use one of the best, you know, national guys in terms of coverage, because, you know, he took a Twitter account and a little blog of, you know, basically what you and I are doing right now, and parlayed that into, he's now a Heisman voter and with a national publication, you know, of putting out his preview. So I really enjoyed his interview, like I said, and what he had to offer, and he was very prepared. And so give Brett a follow if you don't already. Pick Six Previews, all spelled out, PICKSIX, you know, previews.
And he loves to interact with fans. I mean, that's maybe the coolest part about him. On Twitter, he will interact with everybody. So please show him what BYU fans are all about. Support him. Buy the book. It's awesome. Use promo code BYU at checkout. Save 30%. And if nothing else, give him a follow on Twitter. Retweet the heck out of his preview and talk to him. He will talk about BYU football with you and give you a national perspective. He's a lot of fun to follow. Garrett, this has been a heck of a show. We've been all over the place. I want to wrap things up. We forgot to do this last week. We do have some new 5-star reviews that we need to read. So we're going to read a few of these. We've got three that I've kind of picked out today. One of them came in a couple of weeks ago from BYU football fan G Money. Could this be Brandon Gurney? This doesn't feel like Brandon Gurney. I know Gurney well enough to know that this doesn't sound like Brandon Gurney, but Brandon Gurney's also a professional journalist. Maybe he could sound however he wants to sound. I don't know. The review, it says, worth the binge to start from the beginning. I love the content, although I'm not jumping on the cheese pizza bandwagon with Jeff anytime soon. He's wrong. If Garrett sets up a donation link for a better microphone, I'm pledging $30. I prefer a mic over a shirt. I don't know if that's a criticism of your mind, but I will take that $30 and we can pledge it to the Jeff Needs a Ford Bronco Fund. And I'd feel okay about that.
All donations are, what's the word, fungible. So it may get rerouted into...
It's kind of like a Cougar Club, right? Like, we're not going to send you a receipt of what we did with it.
Yes.
Next one, Hoosier Cougar. The title is Cheese Pizza is Better Than No Cheese Pizza. You guys have got to get on board. I had another full cheese pizza yesterday, and it wasn't my favorite, but it was still immaculate. I mean, that's where I'm at.
Is that...
I did have Lucky Slice this week, but yesterday was from another local spot called Gio's Pizza. I think there's only one here in Clearfield, Utah. And it's good, but it wasn't great. And then I went back to Lucky Slice, you know, later on in the week. So, all of these pizza, I appreciate everybody trying to convince me that I'm wrong about this cheese pizza thing, but I'm not. I'm right, and I will go to my grave. Okay, cheese pizza is better than no cheese pizza. There's a place for cheese pizza. I'll forego the Home Alone joke. I could go for a margarita pizza when tomatoes are really ripe. Margarita pizza is delicious. Oh, and the pod, it's a lot of fun. Jeff and Garrett have a comfortable rapport and make listening to them feel like you're having a conversation together. They are knowledgeable and take the time to look at multiple sides of an issue as well as data behind decisions, ranking, perceptions, and ideas. It's a great option for Cougar fans, and I'm anxious to see how the pod adapts when we're in the season and giving them hell. And the last one from our friend Brett Barr, title is Decent Little Show. I'd like to describe the podcast this way, he says. What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point your rambling, incoherent response were you in your, sorry, at no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul. Who doesn't love a good Billy Madison reference? But they said they wanted positive reviews, so here it goes. Even with the lack of sportsing in the world right now, G-Money and Jeffrey still managed to make pods great again. MPGA, a nice mixture of sports, barbecue, and other food stuff, sources, and various other semi-interesting topics. To sum up the first half of 2020, wildfires, Kobe, earthquakes, Rona, murder hornets, riots, racial tension, unemployment, stock market, sports canceled, everything canceled. This podcast seems to be the only bright spot in my life this year. Props, my dudes. Thank you to Brett Barlow. And he's another Davis County guy. We need more Davis County guys to represent so that Garrett stops thinking Davis County is Canada. It's not. It's really closer to Salt Lake than Provo is, but for whatever reason, nobody can wrap their head around that concept. But that's Davis County.
Are you in Davis County? Are you in, what's about Clearfield? Is it Clearfield County or Ogden County?
No, Clearfield's a city, my friend. Well, and Weber County. Ogden County is also not a thing. Weber County. I work in Weber County. I live in Davis County.
Okay.
So really, when people live in Provo, I live closer to Salt Lake than everybody who lives in Provo.
So you say that as if that's a good thing.
I just am saying that nobody thinks that Salt Lake is Canada, but for whatever reason, as soon as you go around the oil refineries, it's like Cache Valley. Like, everybody thinks it's just 100 miles away.
It is. It's a scientific fact.
Okay.
I used to work in Davis. I can't argue with this. Hey, it's up there.
Okay. I mean, you're right. This is kind of actually, like one of those things.
I had to apply for a visa when I worked in Battlefield.
Okay. It's not that far, and it's great, and we have Lucky Slice. And once everybody has Lucky Slice, you will all agree with me, cheese pizza is the way to go. This has been a good show. Please continue to support, subscribe, and share the show in any way that you can. We're growing, and we're having a lot of fun doing this. Your reviews help. 5 stars only, obviously. We don't want any of that 4-star garbage, and certainly don't want to hear any of the negative feedback. Although we may have merited some negative feedback, I don't want to hear it. 5 stars only. I mean, let's have some respect. And that's it. That's all I got, Garrett. Let's give them hell this week.
Give them hell, man.